let's see if I can do this in a nutshell. Hal's gonna talk about what fell down from heaven and what they found later. Is that right?
So, yeah, I want to, in view of what we've done so far, I want to think about the role of reading and writing in the emergence of Christ's movements of the first two centuries. I mean, that is sort of a, well, duh, it would be one response, but it does. It turns out that there are quite a few tricks up the sleeves in that. The first of which would be that, I mean, of the general population in the Mediterranean at the time, the averages, the estimates are probably at best there were 10% who could read or write. So it's really a curious thing that we would be interested in reading and writing in an entire population that doesn't on one level, and then that we know probably, Hal's probably lying, we probably know that the Christ movements were generally of poorer people, therefore less educated people. Just to situate that a little bit differently, however, than what occurs to us once we think about it once or twice, is that we don't realize that reading and writing were understood completely as communal activities. So in other words, the only reason that you learn to write and to read is for the sake of others. That is just simply impossible for us to think about. And so for instance, I've told some of you this, that if someone, let's say, has been working on reading for a year, and is just practicing, trying to get just reading on the right track, and practicing regularly. So all of that practicing is out loud. In other words, learning your alphabet, learning your words, learning your first sentences, beginning to think about stories that you would read, or starting to read stories, everything. When you see the mostly young person doing that kind of basic reading, you will find them reading out loud and pretty loud. And that's because they know the reason they're reading that is for reading to other people. So, in other words, there's really no thought except that I have to, the very art of reading is out loud. That means, of course, that the character of the society itself demands, in many cases, that someone who can read reads whether they want to read or not. In other words, so there are many times where a body needs something to be read, and if they know you know how to read, then you have to read it. And that in some cases that means you're remunerated, in some cases you're not, mostly not. Mostly, you have been given more wealth just by learning to read and write than deserves attention on a payment process. So, Therefore, from the very earliest we know about the Christ movements, there are people writing letters to one another. And one of the main things is that, and we, it's hard to say whether this comes from Jesus or not, or from the general society. But by and large, because by and large we know that a teacher, or probably better put, a sage, a wise person, whose job it is to be wise, whether they read or not, they move around. They travel from place to place. And we have really clear evidence that Jesus himself was on the road most of the time. Interestingly enough, not near as much on the road as, say, someone like Paul. So it looks like Jesus, you know, was like a day and a half away from home at any one time, but probably much of the time, a day and a half or so away from home. Rarely left Galilee, if ever. And then, of course, it seems probable that Jesus didn't know how to read or write either. And so he was an oral sage that moved around. But often there would be people who would travel from village to village and town to town that would either have writings with them or come and read writings that were waiting for them, and sometimes teach around those writings. So that's the picture, and then you have the first thing we seem to know is Paul writing letters to groups, to what we would call Christ groups, some of which he founded, some of which he wished he founded, and some of which he would like to have founded, and some of which wished that he had not even come near them. But he writes letters to all of these kind of little groups. And he is an educated writer and reader. He has read, it's clear that he's read many of the Hebrew texts and probably some of the Greek philosophies. He writes as a part of his teaching. So he's either there in person to teach, or he teaches by writing this, and sending that. Others may have been writing in that same time, in the 50s, at the same time as Paul. It seems likely that he wasn't the only one, but it is probable that he was the only one whose letters were kept that early. It's very difficult to think that much was written in this set of movements before that. The one thing we think might have been written were, so there are two kinds of collections of teachings of Jesus, or collections of stories about Jesus, that could have been written before that. So it looks like there's a set of parables in the fourth chapter of Mark that were written as a unit way before Mark was written, and that Mark picked up and used later when Mark was written. Similarly, it could be that the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Q were written in the 40s, and they were simply collections of sayings of Jesus. it could be that there are some, in the 60s, there are some letters written. As far as we know, probably the first gospel that is written, and gospel is a problematic term, the first gospel was the Gospel of Thomas, a collection of sayings. But we don't have that Gospel of Thomas. We have a later copy of the Gospel of Thomas. So this is, it's unsure whether that happened. But it looks like the way the current Gospel of Thomas that we have, that it is an addition, it's an emendation of what was written earlier. That's pretty, we'd have to find more stuff to be sure about that. And again, I said to some of you in that regard, so there's a lot more to find of the writings of this movement. As I said in the morning, in the last 150 years, we've found at least 120 new writings. And that's because of the fact that two just weird random things happened in the late 19th century. One was rich Europeans started going to the southern Mediterranean for vacations, including rich biblical scholars. And almost immediately, without trying, without thinking, they started finding documents. In the market square and in some primitive libraries. So in the late 1800s, there was just more and more people that were scholars and had made a trip to Egypt or Syria or something and accidentally come upon some writings that they took back, as good colonialists would, and found out that there was things to learn and new things or changes in manuscripts or the like. So that was really a big-time cottage industry by the end of the 19th century. I tell I've told some of you the story of one of my favorite, of probably the premier person who collected new documents in the 19th century was a man named James Rendell Harris, a professor at both Oxford and Cambridge at one time or another. And he went basically every year to the Near East or the Mediterranean. And he would bring home stuff that he found. He was so well known for that that people who would also go and find something would send the stuff to him to see how it looked. And probably his most famous text that was found, I won't go on about this because I've said this one time in this room before, was the Odes of Solomon. We'll look at that in a minute. The Odes of Solomon is a misnamed book. It has nothing to do with Solomon. But many of the titles aren't original to the books found. And James Rendell Harris found that in the following summary, that a student of his came up to him and said, "Did I don't think you sent me my paper back from last semester." And Professor Harris ran over to his office because he knew that he had read it and was embarrassed, tried to hunt through his messy library, his mess in his office, to find the student's text, and he lifted up some papers, thinking it might be down there, and he found there the Odes of Solomon. And he didn't know where he couldn't remember where he got them. They have since been carbon dated to the late first century or the second century. And they're a set of songs, very much like the Psalms, but they have Jesus in them. So it's basic in Jesus-related psalmody. And I'll show you some of it. It's just breathtaking, beautiful, and stunning. So anyway, there's so much of that that was found then also in the 20th century, but at the same time, the colonialists and the neocolonialists in Europe and America were just carting boatloads of stuff back. So another Oxford-Cambridge thing that happened still in the 19th century is they had found an ancient city in Egypt that they were going to dig up archaeologically. But the problem was that there was a real city on top of it. So generously, they decided not to destroy the city. But in their discouragement, they looked outside of the regular city and they found there the trash dump of the ancient city. They spent 10 years digging in the trash dump of this city from the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century of Egypt. They then carted it all up, sent it back to England, and there was at that point a 10-person team to go through the stuff. They did. They worked on it. And there still is a 10-person team working on those finds, still opening things. And they've gone through 10%. I mean, in other words, in their basements, their libraries and things, because most archaeology is not shut down because of politics and military. But there's no problem because in America and in Europe, there are so many things that were brought back that haven't even been looked at. So I just want to say, so there was a lot. So, the punchline on that thing from the Oxyrhynchus, which was the town, the town dump, is with 10%. Now looked at, they've already found two new Gospels.
In the garbage.
So, in other words, we have no idea how much is left, but we know that there's more ready to be found in European and American storage than we probably have ever had. Yes.
Did they also find copies of things we already knew existed?
Yeah. All kinds. It's not just new stuff. So anyway, I just want to say, despite the fact that hardly anybody read and wrote, there's a lot of stuff there. And it turns out that just some random city has Christ gospel that we haven't seen before. And there's a whole bunch, for instance, in that same trash dump, they found seven little scraps from the Gospel of Thomas. So, in other words, reading and writing is a big thing to think about in that century, and is by the end of the first century, you were probably there. Well, you start writing Gospels probably in the 70s. There, right now, we think we have Well, the Complete Gospel is a book that you might want to buy by Robert Miller, has 23 Gospels from the first two centuries, just the texts. And so those, that's you probably wrote Gospels from maybe 70 to 200, or maybe 220. All kinds of different ones. We'll look at some of that. By the end of the second century, you have a library and a school in Alexandria, Egypt, of Christ scholars and Christ students. In the middle of the second century, you have a number of folks trafficking in taking writings from one part of the Mediterranean to another part, four different thinkers in the Christ movements. Still, so in other words, you've developed by mid-second century, you've developed something that you'd have to call something like scholarship or interpretation. I mean, these weren't like, these were people who were passionate about the stories they were writing and reading, and sometimes passionate in a negative way.
How John, your comment about the fact that they were sharing documents, almost like a library system, that, it intrigues me, and it makes me want to ask you the question about scribes of the day. Do you know much about their training or their discipline? I mean, how were they like a trusted agent to keep out the editorialism or to not streamline things to make it easier to write? Were they really trained to be diligent, loyal translators?
Now, scribes, by and large, aren't translators. They're
bad choice of terms on my part.
Yeah. They are the ones who copy things. And yeah, they get fired if they don't do it right.
Okay.
But sometimes they don't know what is right.
So I'm just kind of wondering about that confidence. If they don't know what's right, that confidence that we have that those shared documents are replicated.
So they copy from something that was already written?
Yeah, they copy. A scribe basically takes a copy and makes 10 of them.
So what's the person called who, if you're writing down what they're hearing somebody, a story, verbally?
No one.
A what?
You call that no one. There aren't people that are writing down when people are talking.
Okay, so how did it originally, how does it get written down to start with?
Well,
the author?
Yeah, no, but this is so important, Sharon. Two basic ways. One, orally, in other words, much of what is written probably is in the process of being composed over a period of 2 to 20 years. So, for instance, I would want to say, there's a decent chance that someone was working on the Gospel of Mark for 10 years, and it wasn't just one person, probably 7 or 8. But they were doing that in the late 60s or early 70s. That would be 40 to 50 years after Jesus lived.
So they weren't dictating people.
No one was dictating. I mean, that's not true that no one wasn't. Occasionally a teacher would say to a student, be my scribe and write stuff down for me. But that was generally not taking notes while he's talking in public, but talking to him so he can write it down. So the second way that it gets written, so in other words, orally, something gets composed orally and then gets written down later or not. The main way of composing things is orally still. So writing is often derivative. So for instance, the way you learn to read and write is based mainly on speech making. And so you will write or read a speech. But notice how oral that is. So sometimes the writer will write down a speech to give. And that might not ever be written again. And the speaker might change it. By and large, writing is considered sacred. Not that it's about God, but that the fact that you can carry a thought on a piece of paper is magic.
Yeah. And I have to say right here, to find all that in the garbage heap, that doesn't make sense to me, because that was really priceless.
Yeah.
Stuff to just throw away.
That's right. I don't know how to. I mean, some people threw things away, and other people yelled at them.
Or maybe they were just the drafts, Hal.
The trainer, they made mistakes or something, so they threw away.
Well, so anyway, I think that's the kind of the big picture of the writing enterprise. So I want to say that when we think of the movements themselves. The movements did interact with reading and writing a lot, even though most people couldn't read and write, because reading and writing was public. At the same time, you have to say that most of the people that cared about the Christ movements didn't care about reading and writing directly. The stuff of their movement was oral. But often so this is what a number of scholars call the oral scribal period, in which both orality and scribal activity was going on at the same time, complementing each other. Several hundred years later, there's more that's really scribal in a different way. But during this period, both orality and scribal activity were big deals. So here's where I think you have to realize my kind of people over depend on what was written, because that's one of the only ways we know about it, right? Mm-hmm. And that in the last 150 years, my kind have learned not to trust what we read, right? To see all of the complications of the production of it. So you can't say this is naively produced. It's just all kinds of ways of thinking that gets written down. But in the process, sometimes you'll change the orality, or the orality will then read the written thing and change that. For different persons and for different purposes and for power moves. Not all of it, but those different kinds of things. Some of it's written just out of love. Some of it's written for power. And of course, we all know both of those things lap over in sloppy ways.
This is from the oral tradition, which existed a long time. How much later on, when Christ was, or Jesus was, authority of teaching, how much was shifted into his pocket?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from almost the beginning. So, I mean, I am
the parable, some of them are older than...
Right, yeah. And it was almost certain, I think, that Jesus did teach other people's teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But also, when I'm one of those infamous people who did the Jesus seminar, and we, 100 scholars of us, spent 15 years trying to figure out which Jesus really said. And I'm sure we got most of it wrong, but we tried hard, and we said between 16 and 18%. In other words, a lot of the composition is written in, and I say for John, by and large, for good. So for me, the Mark and Jesus or the Luke and Jesus may have been more beautiful and smart than the historical Jesus.
When and how did the Christian church deem the Bible complete?
Now we're getting there. Yeah, right. Yeah, let's move on to that. So I have... Now let me do one thing first. On both sides of one of your sheets, let's just look at the thing that has 54 at the top of it. And I just want to read this out loud. No, you read it to yourselves for a minute or two. Look at these 54 documents. I'm not saying there were just 54. I just decided to write down a mix of 54 from, and there are many more, but these are 54 that we have. And look at how many you do know and don't know, how many are surprising to you, and so on. Oh, I should say that the P.S. at the beginning of something means that it really wasn't by that person that said it was. Pseudo.
Hal, the ones that are pseudo, do you know? Do we have a feel for who?
No, that just means we don't know.
We don't know. Okay.
We know that we don't know.
But we know enough to know that it wasn't that way.
Right.
In the trash sheets, there's lots of letters and receipts. That's a majority of the written documents. And do any of the letters give any enlightenment on Christian scripture or practices?
Yeah, well, let me hold that until I let you all read it just a little bit more, Chris. Thank you. All right, I just want to blow your mind on this. I mean, to see what you do and don't know. There's no, and then, Chris, the answer to you, your big question is, yes, this stuff, the things that are found, have lots to tell us about practice, attitudes, power plays, personalities, and lots that hide at least the same amount of things. In other words, a lot of them are retold so that you don't know about them. Now, on the other side is the answer, really, to and this I put in the New Testament, I'll just let you, this is lists and collections of writings of early Christianity. But what I want to say is that I was taught two things in seminary in the 19th century. I was taught that the New Testament came into being, one professor told me that came into being by the Council of Nicaea. That's absolutely wrong. The Council of Nicaea never said a word about the New Testament. In other words, we wanted, this was this myth that the emperor sort of ordered everybody to do everything, but nothing about, he did inquire of his secretary. What are people saying about which writings are authoritative? And so his secretary made a list of who was doing what. And so, for instance, right there, you see on the second page, 300 to 350, Eusebius responds to Emperor Constantine's request for more clarity on the authority of writings by dividing them into recognized, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, 14 letters of Paul, 1 Peter, 1 John, disputed, James, Jude, 2 Peter, 2 John, 3 John, and spurious, the Acts of Paul, the Apocalypse of Peter, the teaching of the 12 apostles, and the Revelation of John. The Revelation of John actually is in two lists, recognized and spurious. So, in other words, the first thing we are generally told about Nicaea and the canon simply isn't the case. The council didn't do any actions, no one brought this, but at the same time, the person who asked the council to say, what do you believe, was asking his secretary, what are they saying about the stuff they're writing? The other thing that I was told in seminary, and most people are today, is basically the next thing down on the list, and that's Athanasius of Alexandria, who is a bishop in North Africa. I was telling a couple of you this yesterday. Athanasius, my other professor told me that Athanasius decided what was in the New Testament. Well, that's not wrong or right. So Athanasius, as bishop, every year wrote an Easter letter to his churches in North Africa. And the debate is here, probably 360-something, he wrote an Easter letter saying to his churches, Happy Easter, and saying, by the way, here are the 27 books that you should most read. And they happen to be the same 27 as we have now. That caused my professor to say, Athanasius created the New Testament. The problem with that is you could say he created it for his diocese, right? But he didn't claim that it was for everybody. And then the last thing on this page, I think, is the really fun thing. The Apostolic Constitutions, which was written in the early 400s and was way more acknowledged than Bishop Athanasius, they cited of the list of Athanasius, their list had the same 27, except for the Revelation, which it didn't leave, put on their list. But then they added 1 Clement, 2 Clement, and 8 books that they had just written. So, in other words, 45 years after Athanasius names the magic 27, the Apostolic Constitutions add 7 and subtract 1. In other words, nobody says, well, we can't mess with Athanasius. So that means in the early 400s, you're still in process.
Where was that done, the Apostolic? The Apostolic Constitutions, who?
That was North Africa. So and we don't know exactly who really wrote it.
Okay.
It was a group project, kind of a synod project.
Had some sort of authority, though. Somebody authorized.
Authorized, yeah, I mean...
Commission, perhaps?
I mean, well, so they added eight of their own that they just wrote.
Who called that constitution?
We're not sure who made up that title. So the first place that you might want to say that the New Testament happened is in the end of the 4th century and the beginning of the 5th, in which a big project is asked to happen to translate all of the texts from Greek into Latin, right? Now you've got a lot of churches, and most of them, because Rome still rules in one fashion or another, are now reading Latin. And most of their sacred texts, of however you would want to call them, are written in Greek. So towards the end of the 5th century, you start deciding how you can get all of those things into the people who are reading Latin. There you have the 27 of our New Testament named as the ones to be translated. We don't know who made that decision. And the other thing is that, you know, there are councils. There's a major council in the 4th century and the 5th century, and they don't deal with them. There are two councils that seem to deal with them. They're regional councils. They're not all church councils. Hippo and Cathar. Hippo and one other. I just missed the name. Carthage, yeah. Hippo and Carthage. And they apparently made a list of what were the preferred writings, but no one took notes. So we don't really know which one. Some people say that Carthage had the same 27, but that Hippo didn't. But there's no writing for several generations about them at all. So I want to hear which council of all church decided what was in the New Testament. And the basic answer is none. That's not quite true, how wise again, because there is a council in the 16th century, some of you will know it, that decided, is the first council of all church, at that point it's a Roman Catholic council, that decides there are 27 books of the New Testament. But the reason they decide that and vote on that is because Martin Luther is trying to kick two of them out. Martin Luther did not want Revelation or James in the New Testament. And so the Roman Catholics, they finally got around to voting because he was trying to change it. That means that after the 6th century, that there's a general consensus, but no authority. When you look, and I've looked through a lot of this, especially in Europe, I just go in back to the, you know, so they probably, we don't have any Bibles, any New Testaments put in one book until the 8th century. You can't make books that well until then. So I've started looking through a bunch of those over from 800 to about 1200. And there you find about 90% of them have those 27 in it. Others have subtracted or added. So that's the best answer I can have, and I hope it's unsatisfying.
Well, it's partial. The second part of my question has to do with, it's stated as anything you add to that has to be not correct. In other words, it contains the entire truth.
Right. You know what book says that?
Revelation.
The last part of Revelation, I want to read it to you all. Because it especially tells you where I stand. I declare to all who hear the words of the prophecy contained in this book, if anyone adds to it, God will add to his troubles the curses described in the book. there are a lot of curses in Revelation, right?
Well, that might actually be true.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So, there's no...
I vote with Martin Luther.
But it really is quite interesting that, of course, when you finally started putting that, the New Testament in books, fairly soon you decided that's going to be the last thing you read. and it's comical, for me, on one level, in that Revelation was one of the last ones to be accepted.
Yeah. Yeah.
So last has a nice little joke in it.
And it's talking about itself, right? Not... like the Bible as we know it.
You are right. Yeah. No. That's the other thing. That's a manufactured on two levels. He says. I mean, what the revelation to John is saying is anybody who adds to the revelation to John is going to get all those curses on it. He's not talking about the New Testament. So I guess I want to say. I would propose that with all of this new stuff we're still discovering, with this ambiguity of the authority of the New Testament, when that happens, it feels to me like it, at least on the level of those of us who want to figure out how the Christ movements got started, that we have to assume that for either the first 200 or for first 400 years, you had a much greater family of Christ-related texts than we have. I mean, there was a pluralism about writing, and there wasn't a central authority to establish anything, but at best, some bishop in North Africa saying to his churches something. And if you see the other thing is that if Luther and Roman Catholicism is still fighting in the 16th century about that, that means we have more or less 500 years in which we can sort of sign off on New Testament established authority. In other words, is still troubled in the 16th century. But for me, the interesting and good and positive, constructive thing is to see, actually, those early centuries of writers and readers were writing down a lot of stuff. And hardly anybody was working on saying what's really in and what's really for a long time.
That wasn't an issue.
You know, they yelled at each other now and then, I hate your book and you hate my book and things like that.
There wasn't the struggle to unify and define.
Right. The emperor, you know, seemed mildly interested in that question. But he was much more interested in the belief that's the way emperors work, is you've got the declaration of this, 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 and this, and this. And what's clear is that that most everybody knew that if you put a bunch of these books together, you don't have unanimity. So my favorite thing in all of this is Irenaeus, the great heresy chaser at the end of the second century. And he's the first person who says, let's have four gospels. And he names Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the reason that he wants four gospels is there are four winds that blow and four corners to the earth. Now, right. I usually get a laugh somewhere there about that. That's really what he said. And at first, it's just a great big joke. But the more I think about Irenaeus saying that, I notice what he's really saying. And that is, since we know Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't have the same story, and since the metaphor is four corners of the earth and four winds that blow, what he's proposing is four diverse gospels. He's not saying, we got to get the ones that say the same thing. He's saying, the reason that we need four is that we'll make it more diverse. And the image of diversity in the ancient world were the four winds and the four corners. That's so different than the way Biblicism thinks of itself now as all saying the same thing. And isn't it so basically wonderful that one has really differing messages for different times and different peoples?
Hal, this is a really easy one to answer, I think. So you mentioned, you know, a few times comes up in the literature here and in your comments about, well, there's a bishop in North Africa. And so as soon as I hear bishop, I think structure and authority and organized church. And we're talking the first couple hundred years where we just kind of graduated from the supper parlors and all of this. And now all of a sudden we start talking about titled authority figures. So the organized church, right, I'm sure you can do this in 2 minutes or so.
Yeah.
So when did the church, early Christianity, I mean, we said in the first 200 years, they didn't even use the word Christianity, but yeah, we got bishops. So when did that structure come, and how was it just a loose affiliation of people that came together and they said, hey, let's have Bob's pretty smart and he knows how to read, so he's our bishop? Or how did that happen?
I want to say, John, all of the above. But it's so evocative what you ask. So the first thing to say is the word bishop in Greek really just means administrator.
Okay.
And that's a secular title for other organizations as well. But there too, a whole bunch of the texts that we have here, both inside and outside the New Testament, don't believe in bishops. I mean, well, I think there are four books in the New Testament that have bishops in them. So, in other words, there are strident things in the New Testament and beyond in all of this greater family of texts that are opposing bishops. So your question is even deeper and more complicated. So the first thing that tries to get everybody together is Constantine. He's a newbie, but he's the most powerful man on earth. On what he thinks is the earth.
All four corners of it. He says all four corners of it.
Yeah, right. All four corners of the Mediterranean. I want to just say what I didn't get to, but I just, for those of you interested in looking at things, I gave you on one side the prayer of thanksgiving, which is a lovely prayer in the Nag Hammadi collection, this group of 52 documents that were found in the Egyptian desert in 1945. It's a lovely prayer that includes God being called the womb of all the growths. The Odes of Solomon, this is just to show, to keep up my reputation of not telling the truth. So the Odes of Solomon, I said, are psalms with Jesus in them. Now,
so where he is mentioned or referred to by name?
So here's where I want you to show what a farce I am and help me on it. My colleagues agree with me, that this is written by Christ people. The thing is, it's the word Christ or Jesus is never in it. Now, I want you to look at Ode 36. I'm going to go over 2 minutes. So I'm going to read it out loud. I rested on the Lord, the Spirit of the Lord, and she raised me up to the high place, and she caused me to stand on my feet in the high place of the Lord, before his fullness and splendor. While I was proclaiming in the preparation of his oaths, she gave birth to me before the face of the Lord. And while I was the child of humanity, I was called the light, the child of God, because I was glorified among the glorious and first among the great ones. For she made me according to the greatness of the Most High, and he renewed me according to his renewal. And anointed me from his fullness, I became one of those who are near him. And my mouth was opened like a cloud of dew, and my heart gushed forth a fountain of justice, and my access was through peace, and I was set up in the spirit of instruction. Hallelujah. Notice who this is? I want to say there's no doubt this is Jesus talking about his entire cosmic career. From being born by her, who is the Spirit of the Lord, and who's pretty powerful Spirit of the Lord. I can't see this being anybody else. But what about a text that has 41 of these things in which Jesus is like in every other ode, but they decide never to name him?
Say again.
We couldn't hear.
Never to name him. In all 41 odes, there are a bunch of them that sound just like this. You got to say, written in the late first or early second century, carbon dated, that this is, really sounds like Jesus anyway, but they never say it's Jesus.
Could it give rise to, you don't say the name of the Most Holy, you don't say the name of Yahweh?
Well, yeah, but Jesus wasn't Yahweh.
I know, but I mean, saying if Christ is held as the Most Holy, if they come out of the tradition where the Most Holy name cannot be said.
Yeah, you know, that's got some legs, John. I think it's probably a better answer than this, but to underline how it might be, in the manuscripts, all of these manuscripts that we've been talking about, so I see most of them in their original language. And by the second century, when the name of when the text comes to the name of Jesus, they only put the capital letter.
We can't hear that.
Oh, I'm sorry. They don't give the whole name. They just give one letter. Usually the beginning letter. Mm-hmm. So that would be right.
Yeah.
then maybe there's, but they're not, the Odes of Solomon is not doing that. It's just sort of describing him and then not naming him. So, and for me, the thing I like most about this is simply the wide diversity of spirituality. That you would say that was the way to honor him. That was the way to know him as actually the one without the name. So, I've cleared up everything by pointing to you, and pointing all kinds of really clear things from the writing. Sorry, thanks so much for this weekend.